Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Leading Ideas Talks is also brought to you by More Church Leaders, Stronger Church Leaders. This video toolkit provides strategies to identify and support new leaders and build and maintain effective ministry teams. Learn more and watch sample videos at churchleadership.com/shop. How can we more effectively develop leaders? In this episode, we speak with Bishop Yehiel Curry of the Metropolitan Chicago Synod, Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. The bishop offers his insights on leadership development.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I am Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center, and your host for this talk. Joining me is Bishop Yehiel Curry of the Metropolitan Chicago Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Our focus for this podcast is developing leaders. I want to begin, Bishop Curry, by asking, before you were elected bishop, you were the pastor of Shekinah Chapel. And I just wanted you to tell us a little bit about the church and how you develop leaders.
Yeah, so Shekinah Chapel, it's actually a unique story. It's one of the first in our denomination that was actually started from a camp. Normally, congregations start camps. But the story of Shekinah Chapel is after the L.A. riots in the early 90s, the Lutheran Church put together a camp for African-American males called Simba, Safe in My Brother's Arms. Mm-hmm. And what they learned from this camp, the cluster of youth coming from Chicago were loosely tied to Lutheran congregations or not at all. So they started a worship service called Shekinah Chapel. And Shekinah was never meant at that time to be a church. It was just an outreach program for these kids who were going to camp. And so I started attending as a teacher in the Chicago public school system. I found out about the camp and knew some people who were going to the worship service. And what ended up happening is there's this process by which new ministries are formed. In our ELCA tradition, we call them SAWCs. It's S-A-W-C, Synodically Authorized Worshiping Communities. And that's like the first birthing stage of a congregation, but I wasn't aware. I thought I was just coming to a worship service. And so ultimately in 2007, I was asked to be the lay mission developer, which basically said that this community identified me as a leader who could develop the church. And so we moved to a place called Riverdale, which was about 15 miles from Chicago, impoverished community, landlocked on three sides to rail yards. And that's where we began to build a ministry. And because it was a poverty ministry, we knew we wouldn't have a lot of staff. And so I began the process of really focusing in on lay leadership development. It was also necessary because part of my program meant that I was building the church, but also going to school at the same time.
And when you started, well, let me first say that's a powerful story. And I really appreciated sort of how the outreach moved towards becoming a place of worship. But I want to follow up on the lay leadership a little bit and the lack of staff, because as you know, in your role as bishop, even congregations that are used to having staff find themselves in a place where they don't have as much staff today. So how did you go about sort of determining who you thought would have the gifts for different roles, and how did you become aware of those gifts as you were building lay leaders?
Thank you for the question. I believe in a model that calls for shared leadership, shared burdens, and shared vision. And so if you could imagine, if I'm in school 3 days a week, that means someone else is doing the pastoral care, somebody else is doing the Bible study. And so I started really investing in leaders, and I really used the community organizing model for that. As we were doing our evangelism, the old form is the door knock, and that's what we did. We had a survey that basically asked, what's the top three things in the community you'd like this church to help you with? That's really how I gleaned new leaders. But their survey told me what their passion was about. Mm-hmm. And so I started grouping people based on their passion areas. Too often we get those workers who are very determined, very productive, but they get burned out. But I found that when we're working our passion area, sometimes we could work for 4 hours and it feel like two. And so I started grouping based on passion. And once people were in their passion area, I looked for experts either at the seminary or who were part of my life who could come in and start investing in some leadership development. I think the final phase was what we call our apprenticeship model. Because people come and go in transient areas, we started making sure that every ministry lead publicly identified an apprentice. And so we would make sure that this apprentice was as involved in whatever the ministry was as the lead. And so if there was a change or if someone left, it was automatically expected that the apprentice would be present and available.
So. I think the apprenticeship model in particular is really important. And too often we have individuals in churches that are excellent and have excellent gifts that they bring to leadership, but they have no apprentice. So if something happens to them, or they decide to step away, then we are left with a void. So I think that's really important. I want to continue in this vein and sort of hone in and ask you, what are the key characteristics of leadership for you?
First of all, be coachable. And what I mean by that is sometimes the assumed teacher becomes the student. My mother, Regina Curry, always calls it co-learning. So whenever you go into an environment, even if you're the assumed teacher, you find yourself in moments where a 10-year-old has taught you something new through an example. So one of the characteristics for me is always, it doesn't matter how old we have to be willing to receive some new learning from an adult, from a youth. So that's the first key for me. And the second one is the ability to transfer skills, abilities, gifts. Sometimes we have a mindset that only I can do it or it has to be done by myself. I like to see development. I like to see I've been able to transfer some things from myself to the group. And so the two things I'm always looking for is somebody willing to learn more, and is there a capacity to be able to transfer? And that could be done many ways, from allowing something as small as a Sunday school ministry, being able to transfer to an apprentice, or being able to share your gifts with a larger group and allow them to actually take the mantle and go ahead and lead. Those two character traits are what I'm always looking for in the development of new leaders.
I want to talk a little bit more about those, and particularly the co-learning. I think the co-learning one is critically important, but the challenge or the struggle I often see in some congregations is sort of people give lip service to being willing to learn from younger people, but they don't actually, in practice, receive learning from younger people. Are there some insights you can give of how you tried to help people to actually be open to being co-learners, particularly from younger individuals?
Yeah, so I'll start with the camp I was talking about that was formed, Simba. Well, when I began leading, we expanded it to two more camps. So there's a Simba, there's a Simsa, safe in my sister's arms, and there's a multicultural camp called MILA, Multicultural Youth Leadership Academy. All of them are leadership camps. At some point in our camp, the adults sit down and the youth do all of the teaching, the leading. It go from Bible study to group dynamics to leading songs, leading activities. And so true youth leadership means that it's all youth. And so when I've ever led in this capacity, the entire program has to be planned by youth. They have to be at the table, and it has to be executed by you. And so the co-learning piece, we typically like to put together a program and then insert the youth, a program that they didn't have the opportunity to design or develop. So that's one of the key pieces. But with co-learning, it's also a cultural piece. Because we were an impoverished ministry, and we built a unique relationship throughout the U.S., people would come in with the mindset that we're coming in to help, or we're coming in to do a project, or what can we do? And I would always say, you're coming to be. You know, you're coming to be with your siblings. And in many cases, just by being present, when people felt like they were coming to give, they actually received. And so I wanted people to come into the environment with a certain mindset of, I'm just coming to be present with my family, and whatever they're doing that day, that's what we're doing. And in many cases, there was some learning exchanges that both sides, that was reciprocal and that was beneficial to both communities.
I think that's helpful because I believe that's a challenge that we see continually played out in many congregations. And if congregations are going to flourish, that emphasis on co-learning is something that I hope our listeners will take to heart. As a bishop, we talked a little bit about when you were at the church, how you thought about leadership development. Now that you are bishop, have you expanded the way you're thinking about leadership development? What are the resources you're drawing upon to, as you think about helping congregations in different areas and in different places, and not just one congregation, think about leadership development?
Yeah, I think for me, my context is 185 congregations in the region that I'm responsible for that we refer to as a synod or synod. And I often share that it'll take me 4 years to visit every congregation if I do it on Sundays. Mm-hmm. And so a reality sets in that this one person couldn't possibly do it for 185 congregations. So what I started with was a team. I wanted to be intentional about having a diverse team. And that's something that I feel fairly confident that we've been able to establish. And my four associates to the bishop is where we start with some fundamental workings of, you know, what's our role? Our role is to expand the table, to do leadership development. And those are some of the things that we've been focused on. And so those four associates each have two conferences, which might total 60 congregations. And so we're trying it on a regional level first, and they, in order to have a larger impact, and we've been in office since September 1st, so it's not a great deal of time, but our roadmap is to try and do it on the conference scale, for which there's 8, and then evaluate our effectiveness and our reach, and we're trying to drill down or go deep within the conference. So I want people to know each other locally first, and in our second phase, try and do something more on a synodical level, or we may do something 2 conferences together, then 3 conferences together, then together. So we want the intimacy to be present whenever you're talking about leadership development. So we have as small a group as possible. But my reality is that my fundamental ministry is presence. And so where my gifts lie, I don't get a chance to utilize as much as I did in the parish.
Before I go to the next question, I actually think your last comment is interesting. And talking with other leaders, particularly those who are responsible for, like you, multiple congregations or even in organizations, I think oftentimes that the very gift that we have for leadership is often a thing we have to give up sometimes when we get into particular leadership roles. Any advice on how you have dealt with that to help other leaders? Even in a congregation, I think sometimes you may be gifted in preaching, but what the church really needs is a great administrator or great outreach. So how do you sort of navigate that sometimes as a leader, you can't just completely work where you're gifted?
I think the first thing we have to do is acknowledge it. And I have to be honest with myself that this new learning for me was like a mourning stage too. I spent 13 years developing people. And now you're in a role that's calling for more administration, more ministry of presence. And there is a lot of preaching, but you're not probably going to preach in education again for years. And so I just had to come to grips with the reality of it. And that's what would be my recommendation to anyone, is that sometimes in order to grow, we have to move out of those spaces where so that others can step into them. So when we step down, others step up. And just my realization, I could be present as a mission developer in my career where somebody stepped down, the community asked me to step up. So I have to trust that the Holy Spirit is stirring in that arena. So my recommendation is, first have to own it doesn't always feel good. It's always necessary. It is necessary so that we can inventory of the gifts that are now present. And then we have to learn a new way of being. And so I'm honored that the Holy Spirit is stirred in this way for me to be bishop. And I take my role very seriously, but I also have to take my learning seriously because I'm having to learn a new way to be in the lives of congregations and pastors and lay leaders.
And I want to sort of pick up a little bit with going down sort of a side street here, is as we are leading people, regardless of what position we may be in, sometimes we start losing people. For whatever reason, they just don't connect with our particular style or our personality or something of that nature. So sort of a two-part question. One, are there warning signs for us that we are starting to lose people? And then secondly, are there things we can do knowing that, you know, it may be challenges, but are there opportunities to still have them be a part of the team and working towards the mission we're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, the warning signs to me is always, if I'm not being interrupted by crying babies, I'll check. That is a sign of growth, sign of new space. And so that crying and those pitter-patter of feet and being interrupted by a kid that wanders in your meeting or during that preaching moment is a sign of growth. I'm looking for three generations whenever I'm present. And I'm not just looking for them to sit in the pew, but I'm looking for them to have a role in the community. What are they doing in the service? How are they responding? Those are the warning signs. If we don't have those three generations, it says to us that somewhere, somehow, we missed it. The other piece is we attract 10 years older and younger than the leaders that are mainly present. So I'm looking for the diversity, but I'm also looking for a diversity in age as well. So if the primary leaders are attracting people 10 years older than them and 10 years younger than them, how can we shape our leadership differently to maybe bring in those who we need to remain healthy? This idea that church is only in the walls of where we preach on Sunday is gone. It's done. If that's the way we are measuring our vineyard, then you might as well move out the way, because we are competing with soccer practice and baseball practice and everything else that happens on that Sunday morning. There are opportunities for us to also gather and build communities in the evenings on different nights. And some people call it community time, community meals. There are other ways for us to have a presence in the community. There are other ways for us to build the community of the church outside of the 1 or 2 hour on a Sunday morning. And so I think I'm somebody who have three daughters in their 20s. And as I look to them, in many cases, they want to be involved in justice opportunities more so than Sunday money service. What I mean by that, if it's an opportunity to feed on a Saturday morning, they're there. If there's an opportunity to help someone else or to help a kid with homework, or that there are these moments that they gravitate to. And I find that they would give up the luxury of an apartment and are willing to sleep on somebody's couch for a year to be involved with something that's feeding them spiritually and internally. And that's not always happening just on a Sunday morning. So we have to start looking at how we can be church outside of the four walls.
Thank you. That's helpful. You mentioned as you were responding the word measure, and in the church, whenever you start talking about measuring or measurement, people always start getting nervous. But as we all know, we do need some form of trying to figure out how effective we are. Can you speak a little bit about how can we figure out if we are being effective as leaders?
Yeah, when I say measure, I'm always talking about impact. There is a story on the side of Chicago where I'm at, Concordia Church, 20, 30 years ago, a group of 30 is trying to figure out how we're going to survive. And I heard this story about this ministry that was taking place in the basement of Concordia Church. And it was a daycare. And 30 years later, when you measure their impact, they have three different state-of-the-art daycare sites. They're doing ministry different, but on the Sunday morning, they still may have 30 to 60 people showing up. And so if you were only measuring the people on Sunday and never look at the impact that this ministry in the basement has birthed into something called Concordia Place. So when I talk about measure, I wouldn't just go to that church. I want to now go to this ministry that they produce where something is happening Monday through Friday in three different locations. I'm measuring impact. And I think that is wise for us if we are partnering with the school, if we're in a park district, if we're doing a feeding program that's serving 200 families a week, if we are involved in various groups, we need to start measuring our impact. And I do think that is valid and it's viable. It lets us know how well we are feeding into the Great Commission.
Bishop, as we get ready to bring this to a close, I want to get your thoughts because, as you know, in leadership, it's always a mixed bag. Things are never completely perfect, and things are never completely horrible in most circumstances, that you have a mixture of both going on at the same time. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on how, as leaders, can we work on leading transformation in those places where it's needed, while at the same time sustaining those things that are going well?
That's interesting, because if you have the formula, please send it to me. I think we always have to be trying something new. Mm-hmm. We can never get comfortable. And what I've had to learn is, you know, I've got to be ready to make a bunch of mistakes. Mm-hmm. Something that looks like it's dead may actually be planting roots. Something that I might have dismissed as something that's not growing at all, I've learned it is actually producing fruit. And so I'm always trying to have us pay attention to what's happening in the midst. Where is their energy? Where is their excitement? And in many cases, that involves exactly what you said, maintaining what is there, but also being focused on what is to be or what has possibility. But I don't have that secret formula yet. I'm actually looking for it. So if it's in a book somewhere, please send it to me. But I think us knowing each other, us having conversations, finding out how contexts might be doing, might be handling certain circumstances, I think our ability to connect with another, regardless of denomination, regardless of social location, that our ability to just be interested in how they're functioning could be an answer to that.
Yeah. Well, Bishop, thank you very much. I really appreciate your taking the time with us today and your insights on leadership. And look forward to connecting with you in the future.
Thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
On the next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, we speak with Doug Poe about his new book, The Adept Church, and about what churches can do to move toward a more interactive way of connecting with others.
Oftentimes, congregations aren't honest with themselves. And a part of what I'm hoping in writing this is, as they read it and engage, is really looking in the mirror and being honest with themselves of, am I truly a swamp congregation? Or where do I have those swamp ministries or other places in my church?
So, and honest self-assessment.
Honest self-assessment is critical. Mm-hmm. Then we have to figure out and discern sort of how do we actually take that baby step and move forward. If we think about being connecting with the community, it may be for a swamp congregation, the next faithful step may be something as simple as inviting people in a community to a dinner at the church. Now, this is not a huge step, and still it's inwardly focused because you're inviting people into the church, but for a swamp congregation, that's a big step.
thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.